Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. I mean, days
I feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala, New York podcast.
The world has not ended. I'm still here. You're still here. I'm glad you're still here. I'm glad you're listening to the podcast. And I'm glad Dr. Shante Smalls is here. She is the teacher for this episode of the Meditation in the City podcast. She is a scholar, artist, writer, meditator. And this was a talk that she gave quite recently, actually, called What Next? Meditation for After the World Ends. What do we do when things don't go our way? How do we stop asking what's next in order to avoid feeling the discomfort of the present moment? How do I stop thinking about the kind of pizza I'm going to have in about an hour from now and just enjoy the hunger, the pizza-less existence I'm experiencing right now? Dr. Smalls will be teaching a evening workshop on December 14th, that's Wednesday, December 14th, at the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York. It's called Learn to Feel Your Self-Worth. Speaking of pizza, Learn to Feel Your Self-Worth with Dr. Shante Smalls. So if you enjoy what you hear in this podcast, please check it out. Go to ny.shambhala.org, click Classes and Programs, and scroll down to Learn to Feel Your Self-Worth with Dr. Shante Smalls on December 14th. And now,
when I titled this talk, which was probably, I don't know, maybe September, I gave the staff the title. I was thinking a lot about being in the middle of the electoral politics season, but I was also thinking about it being the sort of end of the solar year. Also, I was thinking about it being, if you celebrate after, you know, between the three major poisons, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. So it's a very kind of heavy time of year, but also a very joyous time of year for a lot of people. So, Buddhist teachings always lend themselves to talking about endings and beginnings and perception. So, we'll see what happens tonight. I do have some notes. As I get older, my memory gets less something. So what's next? This is always the question, right? Because in many ways, we are seduced by the next moment and the moment after that, and the moment after that, always. Maybe I should have titled this talk, What Now? But what next? Last night I was catching up on my TV shows, as one does, and it's really nice to be alive during the golden age of television. HBO had a streaming for True Blood, which is one of my favorite shows. And it was like, True Blood, stream all the seasons now. And I was like, yes! And then I was like, wait a minute, you watched them all seven seasons already, twice. I was so excited to watch more TV and to find out what happened, but I already knew what happened. Because I am still so easily seduced by something even repackaged. that seems new. Like I'm getting a deal, or I'm going to get an experience that's going to jolt me in just the way I want to be jolted. You know what I mean? Rocketed to the fourth dimension without any work. And so I've learned, and I'm continuing to learn, how do I experience whatever I'm experiencing right now? How do I stay with my boredom or my fear or my anger or my anxiety or my insecurity? How do I really touch that and make friends with that? You know, what's here in my head, in my heart, in my body. Well, in this tradition, we take our seat. And we try to synchronize our breath and our body. And we observe what's going on. With me, that's usually a series of mundanities. Tonight was, I mean, I can't remember, but I can just pull from the locker. I was thinking about the latte I had earlier today and how good it was and how I can't wait to have one tomorrow. I have one every day, chai latte every day. I only allow myself one so I can look forward to it the next day. I was thinking about how excited I am to go home and watch The Flash, because there is a four-show crossover on the CW. I really do more than watch TV, but I was thinking about all of you and who is in the room. You know, why did the people who were here for the first time choose to come tonight? And feeling very thankful that you did, and feeling very grateful that all of you came out tonight and that we're here together, and that there's something about you and all of us here that is an act of love, both for ourselves and for the world, that we're practicing right now. You know, maybe before this we were doing something else, and maybe after this we'll do something else. But right now we're here together in this space where we practice meditation and where we practice mindfulness and awareness and gentleness and joyfulness and discipline and generosity and patience. We have a sense of humor about ourselves and the world. We have a sense of care about ourselves and the world. We're interested in ourselves and the world. And even if you can only stay with yourself for 3 seconds, good. You know what I'm saying? Because there's not really a lot in our current situation, our current world, that encourages that. And that's what practice looks like. It is a series of attempts at gentle discipline. Not a meditator does this, or a Buddhist does this, or if I was good, I would do this, but rather, I'm doing it right now. I'm gonna sit down. I'm gonna make some space in my busy, busy New York life to rest in and with right now. And perhaps right now, for some of us, may be really uncomfortable, both right now and in the cultural moment, or the global moment, may be super uncomfortable. Isn't that why we practice? Right? Isn't that something that sometimes we're going to be uncomfortable? Sometimes we're going to be afraid. Sometimes we're going to feel discouraged. Sometimes we're going to be elated and happy and joyful and feel on top of the world. So I remember about 8 years ago, I was sitting in that part of the room, and it was a couple of weeks before the presidential election. And I remember who the teacher was, and he was someone I really loved to hear teach, so I always tried to come here when he was teaching. And there was a sense of extreme anxiety in the room. Like, everyone was on, is it Tinder hooks or is it Tinder hooks? Is it Tinder hooks? Tinder hooks? Is that how you say it? Tinder? Okay, anyway. Everyone was Tinder? Okay, that's, but that's not quite how, there was a sense of holding one's breath. And people were waiting to exhale. And if things went one way, that meant everything was going to be awesome. Like unicorns shitting rainbows or something, right? And if it went the other way, right, because it can only go two ways in our particular republic situation. Because we're a republic, y'all know that, right? Democratic republic. Okay. So if it went another way, then it was going to be, you know, fire and brimstone. And I asked this question, and I was like, you know, I'm confused because what if things don't go the way that I want them to go? And isn't that a possibility? Isn't that part of life? And the teacher was like, yep, sure is. And what are you going to do? Are you going to stop practicing? Are you going to hide out? Are you going to hurt yourself and other people? Because those are all possibilities. And I felt very clear that I was experiencing something for myself, and I sensed it around me, that I was experiencing something that Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche talked about and wrote about a lot, which was this trap of hope and fear that I just was so convinced that if it went my way, everything would be okay. And that I was so convinced that if it did not go my way, things would not be okay. In that particular instance, it went my way, or what I thought was my way. And then a year later, or two, I found myself very disappointed. I thought, oh, this is interesting. I'm no longer happy with the decision I participated in. But what am I going to do now? Part of the answer was I just kept practicing. maybe this isn't exactly what you want to hear, but what I'm trying to say here is that we have an opportunity to really get very familiar with our own relationship to the seductive pull of hope and fear. The very, very, very detrimental, seductive dance that we do with, I don't know what I'll do if X happens. I can only be okay if Y happens. It's hard. It's painful. It's unnerving to not know what the ground below you feels like. And then you remember, well, there is no ground, but on the, you know, relative level. So Thursday was with my family, and we have a very good time together. And there's a sense of poignancy when we're together because my mother passed away 4 years ago in January. And so at this time, 3 years ago, it was very clear to my older brother and I, at least, and perhaps to my grandmother, my mother's mother, that my mother was leaving this world imminently. And you know, when she died, I had no concept for the world without her. So we're, you know, it's still, we're still in this time period where it seems, even after three, almost 4 years, it seems unreal that she's not with us in physical form. And, you know, my grandmother looks a lot like her. I look like her. My brothers look like her. You know, we all sound like her. And so my grandma's here. She's 90, almost 91. And we're my brother's partner. She's, like, cooking up a storm. We're, like, you know, eating so much. We're rolling around on the ground, you know. We're talking football. We're not talking politics. Not because there was any tension between us, but just because we wanted to have a good time. The kids are playing, you know, my niece and nephew are jumping on me, forcing me to play video games, you know, it's awesome. And my grandmother asked for a glass of water, and I turned, and she wasn't moving. And I was terrified. And you know, you sometimes you see in like movies or TV shows or when someone is unconscious or in a kind of something's happening, you're like, stay with me. You know, I was like doing that and I realized like this is, I have no idea what I'm doing, right? But I'm like, stay with me, stay with me. And she comes out of it, and we call the EMTs, and she has another episode, and it looked like this was the end. And I, you know, I was, we were there for her. And it was, there was an incredible amount of calm. Very amazing. And the EMTs came, and, you know, she's fine. She went to the hospital. She stayed overnight. She's okay. And afterward, my siblings and I had, you know, our reactions. And what became clear to me as we were talking was that we all had some work to do around our trauma, around our mom's death. But I felt buoyed in the moment by all these years of practice, and that it wasn't that moment of intense fear and intense uncertainty wasn't about me, but was exactly about how can I be here for this person who's experiencing this vulnerability and precarity. And what do we do now? So we said, you're moving down, we're moving you from Jersey here. You're going to be with us and we're going to take care of you. And now it's a long series of logistics that each of us is taking up to help that transition happen smoothly. And I say that because, again, this is what I've been training to do as a meditation, a practitioner of meditation. That when things go pear-shaped, as they are wont to do, because if we live long enough, everything will touch us. Every single thing. Every glorious thing, every mundane thing, every horrific thing will touch us, intimately or less so. And so it's still a shock every time it happens. Like, I know I'm going to die. I know everyone I know and everything I know will pass away. But every time it touches, it's shocking. It's a shock. It's as if I've never heard of the concept of death before. Even though I've experienced it many, many times, both physical death and all kinds of endings, all kinds of little deaths. The sun going down, the moon going away from my sight, seasons changing, relationships ending, TV shows ending. You know what I'm saying? Still not over Buffy, you know what I mean? Like, it's been like 15 years. So in the world, when the question comes up, both in my life, with a situation like that, what do I do? One of the things I've been really thinking about, really for the last year, but more intensely, maybe the last 6 or so months, and very much so this last month, it's the question, am I the one who's really the most vulnerable in the situation that I'm afraid of? Am I more afraid of my grandmother's death than she is? Maybe. Am I more vulnerable than the people of Flint who have not had clean water since April 2014? No. Am I more vulnerable than the Standing Rock Sioux tribe who's fighting and been fighting this horrific violence that's being forced on their sacred land? No. Mm-mm. Am I more vulnerable than my students who are getting accosted on the street because they wear hijab in New York City? Or my students who are undocumented and afraid? And so my question to myself is, how am I making room for what I can actually hold? How How am I continuing to prepare myself for meeting the uncertainty of this life? Because, you know, I think we each have to ask and answer that questions for ourselves. A lot of people will tell us what to do and think and what it means if you do this, you're this kind of person. If you do that, you're that kind of person. And a lot of people will tell us they have the answers and they're the experts. But my experience is that real, right action comes from knowing your own mind and your own heart. And we can consult with people and we can get with like-minded people or not like-minded people. And we can help make things happen or we can put things into action. But we still have to be in this life. And so I want to ask you or just say out loud that part of the benefit of sitting practice is spaciousness. This gentleman here, Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche, who I am so, okay, parens, this may sound like crazy talk, but just bear with me. I'm so grateful to know this guy and to be his student and to have met his mind. Because he is someone who spends a lot of time practicing and taking care of not just Shambhala people, but offering that kind of stuff to the world. It looks glamorous, you know, from a certain point of view. You're like, wow, this person has on these cool robes. It's got all these fancy talents. But he has no privacy. He is an endless fountain of energy. And one of the things I've learned is that, you know, that he talks about is, I remember the first time I heard it, I read it in one of his books, but I heard him say it in person and it really hit me. And he said, if you, you know, have a wild horse, you give it space. And that seems like the opposite of like activation. But in fact, it is, you let the horse wear itself out so that then it's calm enough for you to teach it, train it, put a saddle on it, put a bridle on it, brush it, give it an apple. For a long time in my life, I just like to, you know, try to tackle the bronco, you know what I'm saying? And like, that doesn't work. You're going to get crushed. Spaciousness doesn't mean inaction. It means, it's like, what can I hold here? And when I sit, I get this stability of mind. So my thoughts occur because I have a brain, and the brain is active, and it makes synaptic connections, and that's a good thing. And part of how, as a human being, I assume other animals do this too, but I don't know. But a part of it as a human being, how I work with that electricity is by creating concepts and words and thoughts. And those occur. And instead of me being seduced by every single thought I have, they can just be happening. And I develop a stability of my mind where my mind is not tossed and thrown by every thought. Sometimes it gets thrown by certain thoughts. The day after the election, my energy was so, I had not heard New York that quiet in 15 years. The only time I remember New York being that quiet, well, a couple of snowstorms, but was, you know, after 9/11. And that Wednesday, I was in three different boroughs. I live in Brooklyn, I was in Manhattan, and then I was in Queens, and it was like, I live in like the second most populous neighborhood. There are like 250,000 people who live in my neighborhood. There was no drumming. I mean, these people are always drumming, you know what I'm saying? In the park, blah, 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 blah. You know, they're always, there was no drumming, there was no one screaming, there's no kids skateboard. It was just, even the train seemed quieter. And, you know, I came here that night. And what's fascinating is that I don't feel the same way I did 3 weeks ago. In fact, I feel so energized around, in this particular context, how can I use my involvement, membership, from my case, in the Shambhala Center, to be of benefit. I have a particular role here in this center, and part of that role is to offer protection to the entire New York City area. That's my role. I have guidance and I have help, and other people have done it before me, and I've watched them and been under their tutelage. And so I'm taking that seriously. What does that look like? Having conversations, contemplating that. What does it mean to be the wind that gently blows the clouds away from the sun, so that the sun can shine down on where it needs to shine? Okay. And part of that, I really want to encourage you, and this is not a sales pitch for Shambhala, do this wherever, however, wherever, whatever. But I think it's really important to be together and to practice together, to hold your people, to find new people, perhaps. And I think that for me, sometimes there are certain events that happen in the world. You know, September 11th, 2001 was definitely one where the world ended in a certain way. I mean, the world ends for someone or something every day, right? But every moment. But my world, and perhaps our world, if I can say that, changed very palpably. Lots of things were different. Lots of things got really scary after that. And were normalized. Things that are not good, that are harmful. And then 11/9 some people are not happy with the results. But we're still here. And we have an opportunity to go deeper. Sometimes experiences that are painful or sharp immobilize us. And sometimes they galvanize us. They help us to galvanize our aspirations, things we've been waiting to do. You know, sometimes that's why we make aspirations on our birthdays or on the new year or in the solstice or... And so maybe this is an opportunity for us to, you know, I've been wanting to meditate. I heard meditation is good. There are even those ads on the subway I've been seeing for Headspace. I meditate to be an awesome rock star. I'm like, wow, that hasn't happened for me. Well, I'm doing it wrong. I meditate to be the, I don't know, they're incredible. I'm like, oh, okay, these people. So that's one. I can't guarantee you're going to, like, climb Mount Everest if you meditate, but maybe you've been wanting to meditate. It's something you've heard is beneficial. It's a lot of times people say to me, I hear them. Here's the opportunity. Start where you are. Start now, anytime. And don't just do it alone, but come here or go wherever, where people are practicing. I have, I'll end after this. I've been very distracted by my work. I work in an industry that's very, what the Buddhists would call samsaric. It's a wheel of hell. And part of why it's so hellish is it's so seductive. And there's so much deferral of reward. But it's also a super ego gratifying. I'm a professor, I'm an academic, right? So it's like, you give talks and people are like, oh my God, that is awesome, you're so smart, or whatever. And you're like, okay, well, you know. Or they pay you, which is really great. You do all this work and, like, you know, they're like, congratulations, you're a professor forever. So you have to do that for 6 or 7 or 8 years before that becomes true. And I've been so annoyed and so irritated with myself, but with also with the profession. And I've had to just, like, turn up my practice super a lot because I have had to. And what's happened is I'm still annoyed, but I'm also experiencing an incredible amount of joyfulness. So it's this weird thing where I'm like, oh, that's not the object of my irritation. It's just a large target. I'm uncomfortable because I'm going deeper in my practice. And I could have an object. There are plenty of objects in the material world that I can point to that are making me uncomfortable or causing me irritation or anxiety. But when those things go away, which they always do, in this, you know, we have term limits. We forget. Our irritation abides, our fear changes. When those things go away, I still have a sense of discomfort and irritation and fear. So I know that on an ultimate level, that it's not the manifestations, it's not the phenomena arising. Those things can galvanize me and I can say, this is what I will do, this is what I will not do, you know, totally, right? I can absolutely take those actions. But there's also a deeper, fundamental even, discomfort that comes from forgetting the incredible, precious truth that I am basically pretty fucking good. And that the situation is workable. Just before I came in, I was reading about the crash in Colombia. 6 people survived, at least. A lot of people didn't, but 6 people survived the plane crash. And I'm looking at their faces, and I'm just like, I don't know how the world works at all. But that's amazing. And when we say basic goodness in Shambhala, we don't mean that there's no harm or horror in the world. We mean that there's some basic sanity that each of us possesses, all of us possess, even our enemies. There's a basic sanity that we possess that we can either cultivate or bury. So I encourage you to do what you feel is right, but with grounding yourself in some kind of contemplative practice that slows down the Twitter fingers. Maybe I'm talking to myself there. That slows down the Facebook tirades. That slows down the self-aggrandizement that prepares you to step in front of, be a shield when you see something going down, and to do that is safe for you. That's why we practice. Not to feel good, but to be here. And to be sane. And there's just love and joy in all of that. So I'm very, very curious to hear your questions.
That was a great talk. Thank you. And toward the end of your discussion, you mentioned going deeper into your practice and how that interacts with your anxiety and can potentially worsen it at times. Mm. I don't know if I misinterpreted that, but is that something that is true for a lot of people? Because I personally started about 6 months ago and have more or less been consistent, and I've felt similar to what she was saying, my emotions sort of ebb and flow a lot more extremely as I've gone into practice more deeply.
Okay.
And that's not something I really was prepared for.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
So how would you describe the quality of your emotions before you started practicing?
I mean, equally sort of up and down, but I think I wasn't as aware of it, maybe.
Uh-huh.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Right.
Perhaps the same feelings, but less awareness around those feelings.
So maybe it's not a question of more or even of intensity, but of seeing and awareness. And so the example that's sometimes given is that when you first start meditating, it's like a rushing waterfall. Mm-hmm. And people are often turned off at that point because they're like, I thought, you know, you sold me a bill of goods. I thought meditation was supposed to be awesome and calm and whale noises, you know what I mean? And instead, it's like a cacophony. But that's been happening endlessly. We just start to become aware that that's what's happening. And so I don't want to say that it's... for me, it's not that my anxiety increases, that my irritation is being the kinds of false niceness and kind of pretend traps, mental traps, emotional traps I have set up for myself so that I can deal with the world, their usefulness is fading. So I'm understanding them to be not useful, not helpful. And so what happens is I'm touching my tender heart, and it's, you know, it's great, but it's irritating. And I'm understanding how deeply sensitive I am and how that's such a good thing, but how I don't know how to deal with that because my own particular articulation of that is that sensitivity is somehow negative because people can hurt you. So alongside that sensitivity is an incredible strength. So at the same time I'm becoming, the heart is becoming more tender, everything else is also, it's like my tender heart is surrounded by armor, but there's a cutout in front of the heart. So it's not as if I'm just like a bag of Jell-O, but I get both strong and sensitive. Mm-hmm. And so the kind of thin skinness changes and I become more thick skinned, but I become more tender at the same time. So it's a parallel, it's a paradox, and it's not just, I don't become helpless and unable to filter out things. I actually become much better at swatting away nonsense, but I become very tender to the things that are real. So I tune into the pain of people much more easily rather than just thinking about myself, just speaking for myself. I am much more sensitive to my own bad behavior. Like I really can't get away with the things that I used to. Mm-hmm. Certainly a decade ago, but even a year ago. I put myself on the hook a lot more. I feel a lot more responsibility for how I behave in the world. But that's a slow... When I was at 6 months of practice, I was like trying to sit for 10 minutes without jumping up and, you know, getting on my phone. Mm-hmm. So I think you can be easy with yourself. If you're on the cushion and it's overwhelming, you can get up because you can always do another session.
It's not so much while on the cushion.
It's off the cushion.
In the yeah. world around me.
And what do you... How are you? What are you doing when that happens?
Breathing, you know, trying to reorient myself and
yeah.
not react.
Yes.
And instead.
Yes.
More.
So there's a saying that some people say where they say restraint of pen and tongue. So, you know, what begins to happen off the cushion is that you have a pause between what you want to say. Mm-hmm. And what is helpful to say. And then later those things maybe become the same thing. But it's like you can think it, that's fine. You know? Or maybe it's like instead of cursing out that person, I just give them a side eye. You know what I mean? Or a look.
You know what I mean? That happens.
Minimize. You know. Harm reduction, right? Like, so, you know, it's not about being perfect, right? But it's like, oh, I noticed my irritation. And now I have, the kind of thing that's weird is like, eventually you realize you have a choice. And sometimes I'm like, fuck it. I'm going for it, you know what I mean? And then I'm like, oh, you know? But you get a little bit of space between that, what feels like a knee-jerk reaction and you know, the situation. I mean, it does feel like sensitivity. It will change. It will not. Do you have a meditation instructor or someone you talk to?
I've used Headspace, and I've been here a couple times.
So you knew what I was talking about with, like, yeah. I'm a better, exactly, like, rock climber or whatever. They're, like, amazing. Everyone's, like, amazing in those ads. I'm like, wow, okay, that's effective, good advertising. So, you know, maybe whatever you're doing, it might be great to have someone you touch in with who's maybe been on the path a little bit longer. A path, doesn't matter. Someone who's experienced and been trained in some form of meditation, who you could have a more intimate one-on-one conversation with regularly, you know, based on your two schedules. Because meditating alone is super helpful, of course, and it's also a communal practice. There's, you know, there's the Dharma, there's the teacher, and then there's the community, the Sangha. And so we don't want to, we want to avail ourselves of all of those tools if you want, but that can be really helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So thanks for your talk. It's the third time I've heard you on a Tuesday night.
Oh, and well, I think, sorry.
No, I'm a huge fan.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
I think you're great, and you say things that are like, oh, wow. So I appreciated what you said about this seductive power of pull of hope and fear. Mm. And I find for myself, there are these two major categories, which are my profession and romantic relationships.
Oh, yes.
Those are like the two big ones where, yes, every other thought is obsession. Yes. And a sort of and a function of hope or fear in each of those two categories. And so how have you, other than sitting, because we know that's the answer, worked with that over the years?
Well, you know, Tinder has made it a lot worse, I'll tell you that. Swiping. You know, romance is really interesting because one of the things I realized about my own relationship to romance is that I was so not interested really in the other person. I was more interested in my idea of that shape, someone just fitting into that slot, which I thought would then mean some kind of security and safety for me in a kind of emotional, psychic way. And I realized that, you know, that level of hope and fear is super, super deep and actually required help with a professional who I pay to help me make connections that I cannot or will not see, because they are so painful and they are so fundamental in this life. But that I also can make it I can also put it in conversation with other problems, which is to say that, or challenges, which is to say that it's not for me that it's so, romance is such a hard thing. It's that I have so much invested, so much energy, so much riding on it. And so it's a default, it's kind of like, you know, we talk about sometimes default thoughts, but it's like a default area. If this area of my life is right, and for some of us that's money, and some of us that's romance, some of us that's money and romance, some of that's where we live, some of that's our job. If this is right, everything will be right. And then you get the relationship and you're like, I'm still dissatisfied. Wow. Maybe it's not the relationship. Then it was like, okay, it's this person. Okay. The next one comes along. Wow, I have a bad picker. Well, okay. Maybe it's me. Maybe I've got something going on with this situation that I think it's going to do something for me. It's going to fix me or fix something. And so mostly what I've done is ask for help and tried it out and, like, you know, realize I can be okay when they end or when there's, like, no second date or when it's, you know, there's a breakup. And I can also feel sad, like, and I can have appropriate responses. And then I realize I heal. It's been a little bit of an attitude adjustment through, frankly, working with, you know, a therapist. You know, and with work, that's been actually a little trickier because the rewards are gratifying to me in a way that makes me feel super solid. So that gets a little tricky because part of what I'm supposed to do for my work is bring a call attention to myself constantly. So publishing constantly and giving talks and blah, 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 and winning awards and applying for money. And so it's hard. I forget a lot. I have a little shrine in my office because I forget. I forget what my purpose here on this earth is. I think it's to be the most awesome, famous, whatever, you know? So there's a lot of reminders. It's not consistent in the sense that I'm always on point, but I set my life up so that I'm constantly being reminded to take it down a notch, relax, and really ask the question. So what happens if I've decided that person, so I do that, that's the one. I was just thinking about this on the way here. I was like, a few weeks ago, I decided that person was the one, and now I was like, who? I mean, seriously, it's like, you know, it's a little trick my mind plays on me. And I've really cultivated other kinds of relationships, really to, like, keep me from obsessing about those two very things, work and romance. So, like, you know, my relationships with my family have really deepened. Super deep. They also irritate me a lot more. I irritate them a lot more, you know. But they're really deep, really close to my brothers. You know, and with work, what I've done is cultivate an incredible amount of friendships, of colleagues, both in my own university and across different places. And that has changed my relationship to work because I'm trying to build, you know, community. So those are some of the things. It's like I've, you know, and at the same time trying to develop better tools and skills around, you know, the tricky stuff of, I mean, I'm not the you know, the tricky stuff around romance, you know, for me. So I don't know if that was a...
That was perfect. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your talk. I'm not sure exactly how to articulate what I want to ask you about, but I related to... a lot of things that you said, and particularly about hope and fear, I guess. I'm struggling with, and this is in responding to the political situation at the moment, feeling like I really want to be aware and engaged to a greater extent than I've allowed myself to be before. And this partly has to do with, like, media consumption and habits, and I don't know, maybe I just need to do things in a different way, but I really want to be aware and I really want to be engaged, and there are a lot of messages, you know, saying that we should be very alarmed, and so I'm struggling with wanting to be committed to being aware and being engaged, but being overwhelmed and being alarmed, and then wanting to go, you know, away from being aware and away from being engaged because yes. being alarmed is alarming. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where I'm at. And
okay.
I'm not sure
Thank you.
How to approach that.
Well, one, I think this is a longer conversation, and perhaps we can talk after the, if you have the time. I don't know, right? But I think if you sense that you're feeling overwhelmed, like, I think that's important to pay attention to. Because you're going to be told to do and feel a lot of things. And, you know, that seesaw is not going to stop for a long time. We're living in a moment where every single thing is monetized, right? Or weaponized, even. Our tweets, our biometrics, you know, I have my Apple Watch on. I'm like, did I get my exercise? Did I get my 30 minutes? My 12 hours of standing, you know? So everything is being captured and put into the marketplace, including our emotions. They are being weaponized and monetized. That's part of living in hypercapitalism. And superstructure is certainly not going to say, you know, take a break from us, from this. Unless it's like a vacation that you're going to pay for or something. But, when our sanity is on the line, I think we can say, if the world ends and I'm not on Facebook, I'll probably know it. You know what I mean? Like, so I think we can, you know, when I find myself waking up and reaching for the phone, I mean, I've tried to not sleep with the phone in the room, but this is a, I just get myself up and go get the phone and bring it in my room, so whatever. But, so if I find myself waking up and going right on Twitter, that I probably, you know, need to sit or walk my dogs or have a cup of tea or do some yoga or go back to sleep, right? But if I'm really like this thing that I'm doing, whether it's watching TV or listening to podcasts, or it's actually activating me in a bad way, then I can just put it down. This is a marathon that's been going on for a long time. Before this election, and, you know, for as long as we're going to be around. So when the speed of the world is trying to, like, capture you in its grips, you can pull back. So I have a couple of specific recommendations. We can turn off our devices or plug out or plug in or whatever. But I would suggest that when you're ready to do, you know, active things, to do it in concert with other people, right? It's really not the time, I don't think, to do things alone. And I think when it's like, you know, I want to check, maybe it's text, call someone, can we get coffee? You know, in a couple days or today or on the weekend. Can we go see a movie? Can we just have a meal together? Can we go for a walk? From a meditation perspective, I would also encourage you, if you like to come here or you like to go somewhere else, to do that more if you're able to. And maybe not even practice, maybe just to, this place is open, maybe just come and be here. You know, maybe there's no program going on, but you just want to spend time in the community room, or you just want to be here, where you know that mostly we're oriented towards sanity. And if you're so inclined, you know, maybe you want to deepen your practice. Maybe you do want to go on a retreat for a weekend away from the city, where the pace somehow slows down and we don't check our devices so much, and we're off email and our phones are off for 10 hours. And maybe that's something that will be helpful in small doses. Yeah. But I think that my perspective of the situation is that it's not that it's new, it's that it's a revelation of things that have been politely been happening for the entire existence of this country. And so when the revelation happens, it's overwhelming. And it feels really new, and it feels really like our feet are at the fire. But you can take your time in adjusting to this new reality. Some people adjust really quickly. Some people more slowly. Some people even more slowly. So I think that that's for you to figure out. But I think making communing with other people is super important. Maybe even more so right now, because it feels so relentless. And I don't want to say that, like, in all things practice, but in all things practice, it's not to say that there aren't concerns once you leave here, right? And we have to pay the bills and have a roof over our head and take care of ourselves and our families and our pets and our, you know, we want the public transportation to function, we want the lights to be on, all that. But it's to think about how we can synchronize these things. Right, so that we're not, when we realize, oh, I'm out of whack, I've felt that way in the last few weeks. I felt tears and a sense of overwhelm and a sense of, particularly because I come in contact with a lot of vulnerable people, both where I live and where I work. But it's to say that maybe my base is not social media and the news. You know, I get the news feed, so it's like, alert, news alert, news alert. So maybe that's not my base. Maybe it's practice widely, whatever that is, you know. That's where I go to first. You know, I can't really meet the world. I have to practice first. That's where I'm at in my life. You know, otherwise I'm a little crispy when I go into the world. And so I need a little bit of lubrication, you know, so that's practice. And that's setting up some ground rules for myself with social media too, you know. But it's okay to feel overwhelmed. It's okay to feel your emotions, whatever they are. And it's okay to not be the world's leading social justice warrior right now. Okay. So I want to thank you all for being here.
Thanks, Dr. Smalls. Thanks for listening. Hey, email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, musings. Tell your friends about the podcast. Visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. Again, Dr. Smalls will be teaching an evening workshop on Wednesday, December 14th. You can see that and many other exciting, well, maybe exciting, or at least interesting meditation classes and retreats on the website. Sometimes it's not the point to be excited in a meditation class. Sometimes it goes a little deeper. So, and sometimes, hey, you are excited. What's next?